CliffCentral.com. CliffCentral.com on a Tuesday morning. It's the 1st of December already. And this morning we will get into our usual African analysis with JJ Cornish. I'm pleased to say he will be joining us in a minute to talk about all the big African affairs. And there's always so much happening on our own continent that we always find it a struggle to keep up. But we've got JJ Cornish, and he is here brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School. With each feature, we'll look right into what is breaking on the continent and see it all through JJ's eyes and with his expert point of view on these things. We'll get into that in a second. Later on, we'll talk a little bit about World AIDS Day, which is today, the 1st of December, and it's the last month of the year. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by 2020, and who isn't, then the good news is it's almost done. The even better news is that for many people, this is a time of year where you get to take a little bit of a break. JJ Cornish, how are you, sir? JJ, can you hear us? JJ? Let's just see what's happening over there. I think we can hear him. I don't think he can hear
I'm
him.
Immensely well.
Oh, good. There you are.
But that doesn't mean you ask me every time. Yeah, I
sorry.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, there seems to have just been a bit of a delay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, good to see you.
Oh, my goodness.
Good to see you and hear you.
I can hear you.
Okay. All right. Good stuff. JJ, it looks like you're either wearing a cravat or you have your mask on hand around your neck. Are you going? We've lost him. Damn. See if we can get him back on this. Yeah, that sounded like
we've lost him.
That sounded like the most extraordinarily long delay in the history of doing these online things. I mean, I've spoken to people in far-flung corners of the world where you don't have such a long delay. So let's see if we can get him back. Okay, here he comes. Here he comes. All right.
The anticipation.
I know, there's much to talk about today, so this is why it's worth being anticipatory about this. Okay, let's get him on. JJ Cornish, if you've just woken up this morning and you're ready to delve into African affairs,
here we go.
The right place. Hello, JJ, how are you?
Still the delay?
I'm back. I hope you hear me.
Loud and clear. All right, so JJ, let's get stuck into a couple of these things. There's a lot going on in Africa. I'm especially interested, and many people are, in what's going on in Tigray, because things are going from bad to worse. And obviously, people are talking about it. I heard someone make a comparison that's almost like the African version of what happened in the Balkans. So give us the top line headlines out of Tigray and Ethiopia at the moment.
Well, we have a prime minister, Abiy Ahmed, who is not behaving like a Nobel Peace Prize winner. You know, he's rather like Aung San Suu Kyi, who won the Peace Prize and then has disappointed ever since. He won't talk to the Tigrayans. Now, the fact is they did attack a military base on the 4th of November. And he just said, well, that's enough. And he's now moved in. He has now taken the city, the capital called Mekele. He's taken it and says that you are beaten. Well, the Tigrayan leader, Gebremichael, has said, you haven't beaten us. And, you know, just after they announced, the Ethiopian authorities announced the taking of the city, rockets flew out of it again into neighboring Eritrea. I mean, really raising the temperature all over the Horn of Africa. He eventually did Abiy Ahmed, African Union envoys, and said, no, I'm not going to get into peace talks with the Tigrayans. He also said that, there will be no mercy. So he's been talking in a very, very bellicose, very warlike manner about this. The United Nations has deplored it and said they want a humanitarian corridor to get at the people. He won't. He says that no civilians were killed, whereas the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front is saying, actually, thousands have been killed. So, you know, Gareth, it's an absolute mess, and that is such a pity, because this is the second most populous country in Africa, and to have the Tigrayans in this way, 43,000 have fled into Sudan, who are now appealing for millions of dollars to look after them, and the Ethiopian authorities have been trying to stop some of that flood over the border. But in all, 150,000 people have fled the fighting. And the UN refugee chief is saying, we need help. Somebody's got to do something about this. But you, Abiy Ahmed, really have to stop talking like a warrior and start talking like a peacemaker.
Well, let's look at the AU, because our own president, Cyril Ramaphosa, is the head of the AU, and he's required to make some moves in the right direction to try and sort out this very ugly situation that's going on in that part of Africa. But at the same time, there are complications because they don't necessarily trust South Africa, and there are obviously long-standing factions within the AU. How well is Cyril positioned to do anything as AU chair?
Well, you know, for the AU to do something, they need to have some kind of muscle which they don't have. So they can put in moral, and that's all they have. This is what they did. They sent one there. They said we've African problems. But nothing that they've done has worked. And Cyril Ramaphosa has had meetings. You remember he had meetings with Abiy Ahmed about the Blue Nile Dam, the trust, South African mediation in that matter. So it's unlikely they're going to do it in terms of a more serious, an actual growth of a war. You remember Abiy Ahmed said, no, this is never going to be.
No, we just lost him. JJ's just fallen off, but we'll try and get him back. I don't know what's going on over there. It sounds like the most terrible connection in the world. I could probably get to JJ's house faster than I could get to the studio if I needed to, but he's somehow on this delay, which sounds like he's miles away. And by miles, I mean thousands of them. Let's see if he's back here. Maybe we can get him to repeat that answer, because I do think it's important, considering it's got our stamp on it, you know. South Africa's involved. And our president's the head of the AU. He said something interesting there. He said, you know, the AU is there to give moral kind of guidance and leadership. But I don't know that that's what we're looking for here. Do we need another toothless international organization that puts out statements? JJ, can you hear us?
I've got you back again.
Okay,
I don't know.
Good.
Keep disappearing, saying, no. Cheerio, you've left the room, but I haven't.
We were just talking about...
you've got like... An invisible bouncer who throws me up because I'm wearing a cravat and spats. Do you think that's the reason?
You got the spats as well. That's very impressive. So listen, I was just commenting on what you said.
That doesn't wear it.
I was just commenting on what you said a minute ago about the AU being a moral voice, but we don't need another toothless international organization, do we? If they're not going to be able to do something, what is the point of having them?
Well, the thing is, it's like the United Nations, and I take the view it is better to have it than it, and certainly the United Nations. I'm a multilateralist, and I believe that you can't forge agreements and make peace individually. That hasn't worked over the years, and when the United Nations came along, it changed things. Now, the African Union potentially could be this for the continent, but it isn't, so it's working that way. But and one can get very exasperated, very frustrated, understandably so.
Mm.
But the thing is, they have two problems. One is they are loath, even though the African Union, as opposed to the Organization of African Union,
right,
is obliged in cases of war to intervene, whereas they never used to. They never would have interfered. But the worst thing is they have no means. They don't have the finances to put up an intervention force or to put in peacekeepers. This has to be done via the United Nations. So, yes, it's right. It's understandable that you become exasperated and call them toothless, because indeed they are to a very large degree toothless. But it is better to have them there than not to have them, to have nothing at all and expect somebody else to step in on African problems.
Well,
you've got to start somewhere. And it's a slow and frustrating business.
Yeah, I agree with you to some degree, but I'm also not convinced that we need more talk shops on this continent. We need more action rather than more talk. But we'll see if they ever manage to get the AU to a point where it can do that. I'm interested in what's happening in Nigeria. We spoke about this in the news yesterday, that there have been more attacks over the weekend on civilians by these jihadis. And Nigeria has been unable to do anything about these people. 37,000 people have died in the northeast. And this has been going on for, 10 years?
In fact, 11 years. You know, Gareth, it is, and Muhammadu Buhari has declared victory in the past. And here they come again. And they killed 110,000, at least, rice farmers. You know, so the farmers are saying, what do? We stay home and starve to death or go out and get ourselves killed. 50 of them, Gareth, 50 of them beheaded. I don't know what it is with jihadis and beheadings. There's also the Islamic State of West Africa with Boko Haram, and they're trying to create this caliphate in the north and distance themselves, break away from Nigeria. Well, of course, the Nigerians would never accept that. Now, various organizations are stepping in. I mean, the African Union doesn't even deign to do it or doesn't even dare to try because, you know, they couldn't possibly. But the region around that, Chad and Niger and places like that have tried, but they simply can't. And the worst thing is that Muhammadu Buhari, having declared victory, now has to say that we can't, there's not much we can do, we must pray for them. And, you know, are they going to get international peacekeepers in there? Would the United Nations step in? You know, it's a long, long process for that to happen. And you really have to have both sides in the conflict agree to put in blue helmets or other people, you know, the African Union or the green helmets. But both sides have to agree before you get peacekeepers in. Otherwise, you have to put in peace enforcers. And that's another animal entirely.
Well, another example of just how pointless the AU can be, at least to those who are demanding action like me. But I think that the Nigerian government have got a very tough battle ahead of them here because these guys are so... They're headstrong. They're obviously backed by religious fervor, and they are determined to keep possession of those pockets of the northeast which they have, and they have the weapons to make it happen as well. They're, you know, backed up by international terror organizations in the Middle East, and they seem to have resources to continue to annoy and destroy and take the lives of innocent Nigerians. It's not a great outcome, is it?
It's a frightening one. And you know what I'm looking at? Having spoken to a lot of diplomats about this, this is the question they are asking. Who is supporting them? Yeah. Who's supporting Boko Haram? Is it just local? No, it's got to be money from elsewhere. Yeah. Who's supporting the terrorists, Al-Shabaab in Somalia? Who's supporting the jihadis in Mozambique? There's money coming in, and we've got to find out where that is, and that money has to be staunched, because I think if you stop those funds, you can start to get a grip, you know, get your foot on the throat of that terrorism.
So, JJ, we've almost run out of time, but I know that this is something that is quite a nice story. It's about an app that allows Zambian farmers to predict disease and pests more efficiently without having to engage in expensive agronomy. Tell me what that's all about. That sounds like a nice positive story.
That area suffered the fall army worm. Do you remember that? In the last year. And this app was developed to start working out where this worm would come from, how to stop it. And now we have 22,000 of these farmers in Zambia get with this app called Agri Predict. Mm-hmm. And they can predict pests and diseases coming, and this allows them to farm more efficiently. You know, we do have an app used in agriculture elsewhere in Africa, or apps used in agriculture in Africa, that allow you to understand how the markets are moving, what should you be growing, what would be the most profitable, and the more we can use it. And you know, the one thing that Africa has done is use cellular technology, the mobile phone. Most countries have got mobile phones long before they put up telephone wires. They could never do it. The colonialists never did it. So they've had this, and they've been using it, and it's fantastic news to see them using technology, cellular technology, to improve their lives, and in the case of agriculture, to feed the people. Fantastic news.
Yes, now that is good news, and it's always good to have a nice positive story to end it with. This, of course, is brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School every 2 weeks or so, and we're able to catch up with the excellent JJ Cornish and get his analysis on what's happening on our continent, something which you won't see enough of in the mainstream media. Thank you so much, Jean-Jacques Cornish. Always good to see you, sir. And keep up the stylish spats and cravat. We wait to see what your outfit will be the next time we interact with you.
I put on a topper, but it doesn't fit over my earphones.
Thank you, JJ. Very good. JJ Cornish, everybody. The African analysis bi-monthly feature, which we managed to have with JJ. Very, very nice. Okay. Kerry says she loves African analysis. Thank you, Kerry. Mbulelo, if we get him back just now, he's busy sorting out the podcast, but we'll ask him about his preferred brewing method. These are obviously coffee aficionados who are very keen to hear about what exactly Mbulelo does to make the perfect cup of coffee. I'm not a coffee snob like him, but I won't have that. I won't have that stuff that that my business partner Rena's happy with. She eats the stuff right out of a tin, you know, not eats, but she puts coffee in a teaspoon straight from the tin. She could care less. Now, she's not impressed by Mbulelo and his coffee snobbery. So, Sia, you've got a few things on your agenda this morning, and we've got a bit of time before we get on to World AIDS Day. you say that there might be, and this worries me enormously, there might be December alcohol bans. What have you heard?
I think this is government wagging its finger at us again, trying to scare us. But it has been confirmed that the Eastern Cape and the Western Cape are in conversations around some sort of booze ban or booze restriction for December. Maybe you might have seen this graphic being shared on social media yesterday. It looked very government official. It was the president saying that Ramaphosa to address banning sale of alcohol. The government has confirmed that that image is fake. But they did confirm that the Eastern Cape is considering a local level ban on at least some type of alcohol sales, with bars and shebeens blamed in part for the rate of infection in parts of Nelson Mandela Bay. And then in the Western Cape, they look at high rates of transmissions in parts of Cape Town and the Garden Route. So they also raise the possibility of area-specific lockdowns in the Western Cape. So in both cases, the sale of alcohol for on-premises consumption is likely to be up for debate. So use it, don't use it. No, I just think they're going to scare us.
Again, I'm not dependent on alcohol. For many people, this is the thing they look forward to, either at the end of the day or at the end of the week. It's something that people look forward to doing. And the minute you cut the supply of alcohol from people, you're asking for trouble. We saw what it did during the first levels of lockdown. It was not a pleasant experience for many people. And, I mean, whether you're an addict or you're just a part-time enthusiast of alcohol, it would be like me cutting the supply of coffee to Mbulelo. He would not be very pleased with that. And, you know, if Ethiopian war leads to a shortage of his coffee, he's going to be very grumpy. And same goes for alcohol. If the government decide to ban that again, even if it's localized, even if it's at certain points of sale, good luck to them.
I don't mean to point out the obvious here in all of this, though. And I'm also pointing the finger at myself here, but this to me, it might be an old realization, but this to me says South Africa really has a massive drinking problem.
Yes.
If you consider it, even from the get-go, we didn't know how severe this virus would be, what we should be scared of, how, you know, should we wash our hands for 20 seconds or a minute, whatever. But we were so caught up on don't take our alcohol away. So essentially some people were ready to like risk it all, including their lives for booze. That seems to me we have a problem.
No, I think we do have a problem, but I just hate the fact that this government still think they can hold on to emergency powers long after the emergency has become a very ordinary situation. Apparently more people will die in South Africa this year from malaria then we'll die from COVID. Now, if that's true, shouldn't we be going into lockdown for malaria every year? And malaria is much more preventable. I mean, we can send mosquito nets around to people, right? There are tablets that are anti-malarial tablets that are available. But you don't see us overreacting to that disease. And if it kills more people than COVID this year, which is what I'm led to believe again, so you can fact check me if you need to. That's what I read just the other day. If it is true, how embarrassing. I can't hear you. See, you're
so right. Look, even with the confirmation of these.
No, sorry, there you are back.
Did I mute myself?
No, you must. I must.
There we go. Spin. Sorry. Even with these conversations or confirmation of these conversations taking place at provincial level, what they did acknowledge in both cases was that officials, I don't know who these officials are hoping that these bans can be lifted in time for Christmas and New Year celebrations.
Hmm.
Does that give you any sort of hope?
No, but I still, because I don't trust our government. I will make sure that I'm stocked up anyway, just in case. You know, so that if I do decide to have my own New Year's party, I can invite people around knowing full well that I don't have to rely on Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma's honorability to to make sure that I have the means of entertaining my guests. All right, the alcohol industry says Nikita is a huge employer in South Africa. I have two family members who almost lost their jobs this year due to the alcohol ban. The drinking problem aside, the arbitrary bans are ridiculous. Yeah. CJ says, here in Namibia, our president extended the sale of alcohol from 8 o'clock to midnight. I think he's trying to appeal to the youth by letting us drink blindly after losing many constituencies in the recent local authority elections. That's interesting. I didn't realize that there were political shenanigans afoot in Namibia. I haven't been paying attention, so that's not surprising. Mark says, it is really stupid. They must not tell me what I can and can't do. I'm not a child. Yeah, it somehow feels like we've been over this territory before, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Let us talk to Christian Wendler, who is with us. Today is World AIDS Day. It falls right in the 16 days of activism. Now, whatever your thoughts on the idea of a day like today, or maybe you've hit some fatigue when it comes to these days. You know, they declared this a day for this, this a day for the other. I hope you've got enough attention left to listen to this. If you are or you know of a young girl between the age of 15 and 24, they fall into a category of the largest HIV-infected group in South Africa. And that's today in the year 2020. Globally, according to the UN AIDS statistics, there are approximately 5,500 new HIV infections every week in that age group, which breaks down to about 785 new infections per day. It's a scary number. I hope this makes you pay some close attention to us. Luckily, we're joined by Christian Wendler, who is a behavioral interventions program manager at Shout It Now. Christian, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you this morning?
Good. I didn't realize that our statistics were still quite so high, and particularly in that age group of girls between the age of 15 and 24. What's going on? I thought we were starting to roll this back and that we were starting to make massive successes in this respect. Has AIDS been pushed to the back burner by COVID?
We have made a lot of strides. We've decreased new infections by approximately 49% over the last decade. It's just not as far as we needed to come. And particularly when we look at our young girls and women, we haven't made the strides there in particular. So we've done a lot better in other ages and populations. But this population, when we look at, we cannot isolate just HIV. There are so many other issues that affect this young population that put them at such a higher risk and make them more vulnerable to infection, more vulnerable to gender-based violence, poverty, lack of access to employment opportunities. It all comes together to put them in a much more vulnerable profile than any other age group. So, yes, where we have made some strides, we have the largest treatment program in the world.
Yes.
We've done on a number of things, not with our young women and girls.
And has COVID put this on the back burner? I mean, COVID is everything that anyone's talking about in medicine and in healthcare at the moment. Does this mean that significant attention has been diverted from HIV and AIDS?
No, we haven't been. I mean, COVID's very recent. HIV has been around for decades. And so, no, not compared to, we've been fighting HIV for a lot longer. And so, while, yes, COVID is much more talked about, we can't say that it has directly impacted. We haven't had a rollback in major funding. I mean, smaller, you know, individual companies, things where maybe they would have chosen to do something around HIV recently have chosen COVID. Potentially, you know, there's been some of that, but by no means the issues, the patterns, the trends that we've seen have been around much before COVID when it comes to HIV.
So tell us about your organization you work with, Shout It Now. What do you guys do in particular?
Yes, Shout It Now is an organization that was founded in 2007, focused on HIV testing, and doing so in a mobile, highly innovative way using technology. So in researching with clients said, we don't want to wait in lines. We don't want to have counseling every time. We want quicker testing that is in convenient places to us. So Shout It Now has large and small buses that went out into communities and started testing people, highly efficient and effective. And from that efficiency, basically expanded into other service provisions. So now we provide PrEP, which a lot of people don't realize. PrEP is a pill that can be taken every day, which when taken as prescribed can reduce your chance of HIV infection by 99%.
Wow.
Yeah, most people don't know that this is available, and that's a really important thing where it comes to education. This is a highly effective prevention method we have. We're particularly targeted with young women and girls, and so that's a big focus of our services now. And connecting that, obviously, for most people, sex doesn't just revolve around HIV. You think about other things. So being able to expand our service offering into other sexual reproductive health, such as family planning, STI screening and treatment, as well as we provide gender-based violence prevention awareness and survivor support in post-violence care. And then we have a whole behavioral program side where we then work on the psychosocial empowerment side, doing prevention programs, both looking at violence prevention as well as HIV prevention. So there's a lot of services that we provide, and Shout It Now, we provide them on these mobile units. So large buses that roll in, so you might find us outside of a T-Vet, outside of a mall, but it's about providing efficient services where people are that need them.
Tell me, Christiane, when it comes to this age group and this demographic that we were speaking about, these young girls, why is it that they're most at risk? What is it about those adolescent girls? Why don't they get themselves tested?
Well, the number one reason is stigma and discrimination, unfortunately. It's the number one reason why people of any age group don't. And we still have, sadly, this many decades into the epidemic, we still have great stigma attached to people. I don't want to go get tested and know my status because then I'll have to tell people or tell my partner. I don't want to, if I am positive, I don't want to adhere to my treatment or have my treatment because people know I'm positive. And, I mean, we still see people having, you know, getting kicked out of their homes, people being, you know, removed out of relationships because of their status. And so that stigma is still there. And you magnify stigma and discrimination by much greater for young people, because then we're saying, wait a minute, you're not supposed to be having sex. So we're going to judge you for any decision you're making where it comes to your sexual reproductive health and decisions at that age. So we already are blaming and stigmatizing, despite the fact that, you know, we're not real looking at, you might not be choosing to have sex. So if we judge you when you come in and you're asking for family planning and we immediately are 16 and we say, why are you having sex? You're too young. Might not be that she's choosing to have sex. So she's trying to make a good decision for herself, and we're judging her as service providers rather than serving her. So then there's a double stigma that she's facing, and we're putting up a barrier to her access to services. So these things exist for any age and population, but you can just magnify them when it comes to young women, because we expect they're still children, so therefore they're supposed to do as we say, and they don't have the same level of freedom and choice and access. And then, like I say, you factor in things like economic impact, transport, getting to facilities, having the funds to get to facilities.
When we talk about all those funds, I mean, it's worth also saying that PEPFAR, which is the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, has been integral in making it possible for some of these great initiatives to be funded. They cost a lot of money, as you were saying, these buses going around testing people and trying to do whatever we can to stem the tide against this this terrible disease, which really has ravaged sub-Saharan Africa. So PEPFAR deserve a round of applause at very least, and our gratitude for the work that they're doing here. This is not something funded by the South African government. It's not something funded by private healthcare. This is being funded by U.S. taxpayers.
It is, and an American living abroad, PEPFAR is one of the things I'm absolutely most proud of my government for. Most people don't understand how massive PEPFAR has invested over $80 billion in the fight against HIV, TB, and malaria. Right. And so it's a huge commitment, and wow. It's done a lot of amazing things. The important thing, though, just to make sure, a lot of people don't realize this, is South Africa, the African government funds the ARVs, which we have the largest treatment program in the world. And so from any host government that PEPFAR works with, the South African government is the largest host funding government. And it's important to understand, a lot of people don't realize how huge the South African government's commitment to treatment is. But that's how big our epidemic is here. Even though we have the largest treatment program in the world funded by the South African government, there's the prevention work. There's still all of the other biomedical prevention, such as PrEP, And so we're so big here. And so that's where PEPFAR and the U.S. government do work in partnership. But it is important to recognize the huge commitment by the government as well.
Well, thank you for your time. You can contact Shoutit Now. You can go to www.shoutitnow.org, or you can speak to a call center agent. They've got call centers. Just look them up. But I think the best way to do this is shoutitnow.org. You can find them on the internet, and you'll be able to get hold of them, particularly if you are someone who is, you know, worried about a relative, worried about a friend, worried about someone that you know well, someone who requires information. You know, the first thing you need to do is let people know what's actually going on and what help there is at hand and what possible treatments there are, whether or not they've already encountered HIV in their lives. It's good to know what's going on. And as we were talking about just a moment ago with Christiane, having the correct prophylaxis as well, and things like PrEP, which are becoming tremendous weapons in the fight against HIV. So go and check all of that out. Thank you so much, Christiane. It's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you so much for the time this morning, and it's an important issue.
Thank you, absolutely. Christiane Wendler, the Behavioral Interventions Program Manager at Shout It Now. It is a Tuesday morning, and it's the first day of a brand new month. Just 24 days till Christmas. Think about that.
Jeez.
It's all happening. Yeah. It's all happening. Sure, there's so much to talk about today, and there's so much going on that I don't think we're going to have time for all of it, but we've got Blind History coming up in a minute or two, which is absolutely, you know, today's, for those who like adventure and like action, today's episode features some of the most famous pirates in history.
How did you get to this topic?
I think it was one that was actually suggested by one of our listeners. You know, we try with Blind History to take the ideas of people who listen to the show and enjoy the show and create episodes around their own interests. We've had some very good suggestions from some of the listeners there. So if you've been involved in that, thank you. Mm-hmm. A few messages from some of the people who are listening this morning and who want to talk about a potential ban. People think it's just ridiculous that that people are even thinking about a ban on alcohol again in South Africa. And again, we just have to say that this is under discussion, but it is not something that's been seriously thought about as a nationwide ban. People are trying to figure out where it's most problematic and where they could possibly clamp down in the Eastern Cape and the Western Cape, but they're not suggesting that this is going to happen before anyone panics. A fact check for me this morning. Gareth, you mentioned the planes take off at speeds of 600 kilometers an hour. Not true. Jumbos take off at a speed lower than 300 kilometers per hour. So thank you for that. I wasn't sure. So what do I know? Thank you, Carla. That's very good to know.
I'm surprised it's by 300 kilometers.
It's not that fast. I mean, I think that's fast for a land speed, sure. But I didn't realize that they could go that slowly and still be able to take off. So there we go. Speaking of suggestions from people on Blind History, have you ever thought of dedicating an episode per season to the quirky facts from history. This is from Mautitz. It says, here's an interesting story. The other day I discovered in the 16th century the English had bred dogs solely for the purpose of turning meat on a spit. They were called turnspit dogs. These poor dogs had to run on a contraption that was like a hamster wheel to cook meat on a spit. So the dog would run on the wheel and the spit would turn. Similar to the way a hamster does it. Even more disturbing is that before they started using the dogs, the job was allocated to small children. They had to crank the spit by hand and did so completely naked because the heat from the fire was too intense.
What? Yeah. What?
Yep. It makes you realize that kids putting zippers on jeans in a factory in China should stop complaining and count their blessings. That's from Moritz.
I'm getting way too many visuals. That is too descriptive.
That's just amazing. A child.
And then who thought about, oh, yeah, actually, no, never mind. We can train dogs to do this. That's. I actually want to Google that after this.
Excellent. It's that kind of thing.
Weird. Yeah,
history is full of bizarre things human beings did. I've gone down the rabbit hole in the last few days since we were talking about this just yesterday. But now I've been watching these Margaret Thatcher YouTube interviews. There was one interview where a Swedish woman was, she did a pretty smart interview with Margaret Thatcher. She was asking her about her time as prime minister. So it must have been in the later 90s when Margaret Thatcher was no longer prime minister. Anyway, at the end of her interview, she says, I do this thing where I get all the guests on my interview to do a little gimmick. So Margaret Thatcher looks at her. She goes, yeah.
Uh-oh.
And she goes, what I want is for you to just do a get up and to do a little jump, just to jump in the air. And Margaret Thatcher goes, certainly not.
Oh, no.
And this woman, she pushes. She's like, no, but everyone's done it. You know, you'd be surprised who's done it. She goes, I am not the kind of person who does tiny little jumps in the studio. I am someone who does great leaps forward, and I'm not prepared to do something so absurd. This woman was floored because she just had no way around it. So she says to Margaret Thatcher, Gorbachev did it. So Margaret Thatcher goes, well, you amaze me. Imagine what he thinks of free, liberal Western democracies when this is the kind of thing you want him to do in an interview. And she tore this woman to pieces for about 3 minutes, just refused point blank to take part in any of this. She goes, but you know, it just shows another side of a person. Margaret Thatcher goes, I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to be popular and make people look normal. Well, I've dedicated my life to changing things, and I will not take part in this absurd charade. You should be embarrassed that you should even ask me to do something so puerile. Shit, that was good. It was so good. I know, but it was so good to see Margaret Thatcher just saying, no, I'm not going to do your stupid jump. And the Swedish interviewer just kind of went off quietly into the background. But how funny.
Yeah, I mean, also read the room and know who you're talking about. Thatcher, to me, seems like she would lick envelopes as fun.
She was not into fun. She was a very serious person. And thank God. I mean, you know, Bulela always talks about how Angela Merkel is a very serious person. You can't imagine Angela Merkel having a whole lot of fun. But she gets things done. Don't complain when you end up with someone efficient. And the same goes for people who are not enjoying, Pravin Gordhan. He's efficient. He's not very fun.
She'd get a little thrill when there's that sweet taste and she feels.
What a marvelous envelope. What a marvelous envelope. Anyway, so yes, Margaret Thatcher and Angela Merkel, interestingly enough, I've just been reminded by Mbulelo, both of them were chemistry graduates. They both studied chemistry. So that's interesting, too, as a little side fact. All right, it's time for Blind History. This is an episode all about pirates. It is the 10th episode in our fourth season. Anthony Miederer and I get into Arg Pirates, and you'll be able to hear all of that. And there's more on the way. We're almost at the end of the season, though. We've got a special surprise at the end of this season. One of the world's most famous historians, joins us, the author of many books on some of the most interesting parts of history, books which we have used as source material for some of the episodes of Blind History, and that is coming up at the end of the season. So stick around for that and a whole lot more. CliffCentral.com on Tuesday, the 1st of December. Get on with your day, and hopefully it's a very productive one. Don't forget, if you're an SME or a small business and you need a bit of advertising, a bit of free marketing, along with Ozo, we made that possible. Just use social media and get on there ASAP. Use the hashtag somebody's business, because we want to make your business our business and help your business to grow and hopefully get some extra work done over the holidays when things are usually a bit slower. We'll tell someone about your business for you. You just need to send us an email, contact@cliffcentral.com, or use the hashtag somebody's business on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. LinkedIn's very helpful for this. And we'll try to get all that info together, but there will be 6 slots available for you and for your business. So please do it today. Here's Blind History. Thanks to Hollywood, we think of pirates as romantic heroes, swashbuckling treasure hunters, and adventurous sailors. They were all those things, but the high seas were a place of dread, monsters, and death. And the real pirates were dangerous. They would capture your ship, cut off your head, and take everything you cared about. And sometimes, the law let them do it. Shiver me timbers, shiver me soul. There are men whose hearts are as black as coal. Arrgh, me hearties. I mean, it sounds like such a twee and ridiculous thing to say at the start of an episode about pirates, but pirates have been a part of human history since seafaring was a part of human history. You know, there's always someone willing to steal, and if you steal out at sea, you're called a pirate. That's pretty much the best definition I can come up with. Anthony Meader is with me. He's my co-host. This is Blind History. Ant, do you agree with my definition?
Yeah, 100%. I just think to add to the RR, I think that was just because they were drunk and they couldn't talk because of the rum.
You know, the only way to start an episode like this, because I know everybody, even kids at primary school, have their favorite pirate. I remember I did a project on them when I was in, grade 4 or whatever. And you learn the big names like Blackbeard and Barbarossa and those guys, but it started way, way before that. The ancient Egyptians knew about pirates, right?
Correct, yes. I think, as you mentioned, as people started using boats, that's when piracy started in some form. And definitely the Egyptians, as being the powerhouse before the Common Era, there was definitely a lot of pirates involved.
Now, I remember reading Asterix books as a kid obsessively. I'm sure you did too. It's probably one of the reasons I love history so much. But in Asterix, the pirates make regular cameo appearances. Basically, whenever they're at sea, the pirates pitch up.
Correct. And they always seem to get the short end of the stick.
They always end up sinking.
So it's been romanticized, I think, prior to the Caribbean and all that. But these guys were scary. They drank hard. They swore.
Women were used left, right, and center.
Exactly. 100%. And then we talk about eye patches. You see there's a little parrot on their shoulder and they've got eye patches and wooden legs, but this was serious business. I mean, they risked serious injury from the tough and the violent life that they had at sea. So, you know, arms and legs, and I suppose eyes for that matter, were the body parts that most commonly lost, and they got these. There was some strange system, the compensation system for pirates around the world where they could actually get a peg leg made or a silver arm
or a patch over their eye or whatever.
Or a patch over their eyes.
We see them in every caricature of pirates. They've always got something missing, you know.
Correct. But that's actually what really happened. Because if they had too much rum and they fell overboard and broke their leg, they'd drag them back out and they have to put a peg in.
Pirates at the peak of the Roman era were actually a very commonplace thing as well. And they were a major problem. In fact, armies had to contend with them. And there were sea battles very often with whole fleets of pirate ships.
And a lot of big names were involved in this. Marcus Antony, who I think a lot of people know with Cleopatra, etc., his granddad was killed by pirates. And the pirates in the Mediterranean, in the Eastern Mediterranean, got so bad that they got one of their greatest generals, or one of the greatest generals in Roman history, Pompey the Great, to actually go and sort the pirates out, which he actually did. But it got to such a level that they really had to launch all attack on them.
The other interesting thing about pirates, and we'll get to these when we start looking at the individuals in each story, because there are amazing, amazing stories. You almost can't cover them in hours, let alone minutes. But there were women. Women were also pirates, and some very famous women were pirates.
I think also later on in the Golden Era, which was the 1700s onwards, there were some famous women. Anne Bonny was one. Mm-hmm. Mary Read was another one. And they were actually closely linked to one of the famous pirates, which was Calico Jack.
Okay, so let's start with someone who people don't even know is a pirate, because there was a small difference between pirates and privateers. Privateers were people who were basically doing exactly the same thing that pirates were, stealing, sinking ships, causing havoc on the seas, but they were sanctioned by governments. So the Spanish government or the British government at that time, you know, the English Queen in this case that we're about to discuss, they gave them a notice that they were able to carry out these pirate activities and be protected by the sovereign. And the most famous guy who I didn't know was a pirate until very recently was Francis Drake.
You know, growing up and reading about Francis Drake, he was the first Englishman to circumnavigate the world. I mean, this is what, you know, explorer like Magellan or Columbus. But actually, he was a proper pirate. You call him a privateer. But he grew up with the Hawkins family, who were his second cousin, and they were notorious in terms of pillaging on sea. And he started with his second cousin taking slaves across from West Africa, across into the New World, as they call it, into the Indies, which is West Indies today.
That's right. Now, he obviously was also well known for being an explorer and, you know, one of Queen Elizabeth's favorites, one of the people who she regularly gave money to. He plotted mutinies. He raided Spanish ports. The Queen just loved him. She knighted him upon his return, and he helped to defeat the Spanish Armada eventually. So he was a hero and a villain in the same life.
I didn't know that this guy was so talented at the pillaging side, but he was an out-and-out pirate, but great entrepreneur. And all he was really interested in was plunder. It was part of his DNA to plunder, and that's what he did. Under the guise of Queen Elizabeth, I think she had a soft spot for him. And she called him my pirate. So, I mean, that definitely explains it. But she invested her own money privately in his escapades as well.
Well, I mean, what you're talking about is almost one of the first really corporate entities that was selling shares. She was basically buying stocks in piracy.
That's 100%. And then when people started looking skew at her, she had to do something. And I think he got into a bit of trouble, but he was never going to be taken out. But I think he was killed fighting for England.
Well, before he came along, I mean, there were two famous brothers, and people usually only remember the one, but the Barbarossa, which means red beard in Italian, brothers, Arouge and Hazir, they both came from North Africa, so our own continent featuring quite prominently here. They got rich by capturing a whole lot of European vessels in the Mediterranean, obviously. And their early victims were popes, Sardinian warships, the Spanish, and even the Ottoman Sultan. And then eventually he hired them basically to take care of the Barbary coast. In fact, that coast is named after them, the Barbarossas.
They stood out like you cannot believe, because Southern Europe, you know, most people have got black hair. And these guys, they had these big red beards. And they were quite frightening, but they were extremely successful to such an extent that they were given governorships of, I think it was Tunisia and possibly Algeria by the Ottoman Sultan.
These guys were also eventually drawn into what was basically a war, because there was a Holy League which was formed by the Pope in order to destroy the Barbarossas, and it turned into a kind of religious war at sea almost, even though these guys were much more into lucre than they were into God.
You know, when we look into and research pirates, they've actually had a big say in the course of history. And this particular instance, 100%, the Christian Crusades that you're talking about, they actually were based in Rhodes. And in the end, the Barbarossas cleaned them out. The leaders of the time around the world, Elizabeth, as you mentioned before, and the sultans, etc., the Dutch, they almost, in a way, hired mercenaries. They used them to achieve a goal in what we would call a Cold War, because there wasn't an official war going on, but they could still fight this Cold War with these pirates or privateers.
Of course, not all of them were terrible people. Some of them didn't even kill anyone, but they developed this reputation as a group for being ruthless and merciless and violent and cold-blooded. And I know how people who listen to Blind History love a bit of gory description. And there's some special mentions here for Lolonais. He was in the Caribbean, which was a favorite place of many of these pirates, somewhere around the 17th century, right? And he would apparently hack his victims to pieces bit by bit or squeeze a cord around their necks until their eyes popped out.
Launay was one of the worst. At a stage, there were two sailors that he thought were about to start a mutiny, etc. He couldn't trust them. So he basically cut the one heart out and bit into the heart. And then obviously the next one was very scared and became very compliant.
He eventually got back what was coming to him because apparently in 1668, he was captured and eaten by cannibals. So, you know, it didn't all go well.
No, you know, the wheel definitely turned on him. One I really enjoyed was, which I didn't know anything about, was what they called the Black Monk, which his name was Eustace, born in northern France on the coast. And he, for some reason, decided to join a monastery. But he caused such havoc that he was expelled from the monastery. But his name, they kept his name as the Black Monk. But he sold himself to the English, and King John used him extensively to fight the French. And at the same time, he would pillage. But he changed sides, whoever would pay him top dollar or whatever it was called, the currency at the time. And then he switched over to the French. So he was really, really hated by the English. And they finally chopped his head off, and then they paraded it to everybody just to know, don't ever change sides.
It's amazing what, when you read these stories, what people had to do to frighten the common people into behaving themselves, parading a chopped off head around. You know, fear was the only way that anything was ever managed, you know.
Yeah, and I'm sure you'll raise it later, but Blackbeard was famous for using that fear factor.
Absolutely. So Henry Morgan was an interesting guy, by no means the most dangerous or deadly pirate, but he was probably the best known of the buccaneering era because he once ordered his men to lock the inhabitants of a port inside a church so that they could plunder the town without the people bothering them. He moved on to capture Portobello, which is in Panama, and he created a human shield out of priests, women, and the mayor. And I know this sounds like a pretty awful person, but over the next few years, he actually ended up serving as governor of Jamaica in 1678. And ironically, the Jamaican legislature, while he was in charge there, passed an anti-piracy law, which means that he was prosecuting his former shipmates, basically.
He did spend some time in jail back in England because he pushed the limits too much, and then they had to do something. So they did chuck him in jail. But when he came back, he decided to retire because he used his money. He was actually quite clever, and he used his money to buy plantations. So he actually settled down to retirement, but he didn't live very long, Gareth. I think in the 50s, he drank himself to death, telling stories to everybody about his pirate days.
Well, it must have been a hell of a lot of good stories, though, that's for sure.
Definitely. Germany's not known for their pirates. You know, there's only a small part of their coast that's facing the sea. And in the 1300s, there was a very popular sea route between Russia and England and Sweden and Denmark. And this individual, Storterbiker, he would basically extort the region. In other words, if you want to come through this region, you need to pay me money. And that was his main way of earning money. But the big thing about him was when he died, he said to his captives, when the Germans caught him, he said, listen, please set my crew free.
Yeah.
So obviously they weren't going to do that. But then he mentioned, look, cut my head off and see how many crew I can walk past and please set those crew free. And ultimately, in the end, apparently, they cut his head off and he walked, still carried on walking past 11 of his crew members. This is obviously embellished.
Sure.
But that's sort of the legend behind Storterbaker.
Again, grisly as hell. Captain Kidd deserves a mention because he apparently killed some subordinate with a wooden bucket once. He stopped in New York and buried treasure, which people are still trying to find. And he was actually arrested before making it back to England, and he was tried and executed, and his decaying body was displayed on the banks of the River Thames as a warning to other people who wanted to be pirates. Again, grisly.
Yeah, and it just shows you exactly what you said earlier, that that's how they warn people, by fear and intimidation.
Now, Madam Cheng, and we covered an amazing Chinese empress not so long ago, but Madam Cheng was probably the most powerful pirate in the world for a very long time. She took over a business that was started by her husband. It was the largest pirate confederation in history. She expanded it even further. Apparently, she had 1,800 ships and 70,000 men at her command. I mean, that's the size of some countries' navies at the peak of World War II. And She really did have an incredible hold over these people. And as a woman, again, it's all the more remarkable because this was such a violent and masculine world. They attacked ships in the South China Sea. They kidnapped British sailors. And they really were just incredibly dangerous people.
And arguably, she was the most efficient, most effective pirate.
Oh, yeah. And most of their business was actually through opium smuggling. But she started off as a prostitute and then, you know, piracy called her and she took to it like a duck to water.
But they did get a bit tough on piracy and she knew that that game was up. So then she just took to a quieter life in her golden years running, I think it was drug smuggling operations.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So something small, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
We should turn our attention to the biggest and most famous pirate of all, the one who's the inspiration for Johnny Depp's character to a large degree, and he makes a cameo appearance in Pirates of the Caribbean. I don't know, there have been so many books and so many movies about him, but Edward Teach, if that was his real name, or Blackbeard, as he was better known, was quite an incredible guy. If you saw him, if he walked out of the cannon smoke, you would see a man with long braided facial hair. He'd have a brace of pistols in his bandolier. He had daggers across his chest and in his mouth, where he'd hold a dagger in the teeth, like they, you know, they make it look like in the cartoons. All pirates did that. And he would have smoke coming out of his ears because he had, you know, these two fuses basically in the hat, and they would make it smoke wherever he went. So he was a terrifying guy. If you expected to see a vicious, evil pirate, this was pretty much the picture that you would be delivered.
And he wanted to do that. That was definitely his persona, was everything. He grew his beard just below his eyes, and then he grew it horizontally out. So he really, really looked scary. He wanted to be something from the dark world, because ultimately, in the end, they didn't want to spend most of their time fighting the ships they wanted to take over. They just wanted to plunder, make it simple, kill the people and move on. And if the people were scared, they would just go on their hands and knees and let them carry on. So that's really what he wanted to do. It was the easiest and quickest way for them to plunder.
He obviously is also one of those people who's written in legend that he received 20 stab wounds and 5 gunshot wounds before he eventually died. And he was probably the most famous guy during what they call the golden age of piracy. And it would only last a few years after he died.
So that golden age of piracy, it was very, very short. It could have spanned a couple of decades where all of these pirates, Calico Jack, Blackbeard, they were all operating in the Caribbean and up the east coast of the United States. But the pickings started to get slimmer and slimmer. And slowly but surely, these guys, they died out.
Tell me about Calico Jack. You've mentioned him twice already, and I don't know very much about him.
So Calico Jack, or John Rackham as they called him, he was a pirate. Initially, he was a quartermaster on Charles Vale's boat, who was another vicious pirate. And he mutinied on Charles Vale because he said that he got soft because he ran away from a French warship. But ultimately, in the end, I think Calico Jack also ended up not having a great reputation because near the end of the era, he met Anne Bonny, and he had Mary Read on his boat, and they had a relationship, Anne Bonny and himself. And as they plundered and carried on, they formed a formidable force. But where he met his end was they decided to have a big party. They just plundered the ship and they had lots of rum. They got drunk, and there were a lot of government boats searching for pirates, and they got so drunk they started firing their pistols. The government boats heard about it. So they tried to run away, but when you're drunk, it's very difficult to be a great seaman. So they caught them and they basically hang him. I think it was called, there's a name, there was a certain hill where they've killed tons and tons of pirates in Jamaica. And the night before he was killed, Anne Bonny came to him and said, well, if you fought like a man, you wouldn't die like a dog.
Sure. This Mary Read was quite a work of art as well. She was fearsome. I mean, like many women at that stage who were doing men's work, she had to dress up as a man, and they discovered, often to their detriment, that it was a woman when it was too late.
Anne Bonny and Mary Read were fearsome. Often they would be fighting till the death, the men, pirates or whatever that term might be, they were below deck. And they'd scream, come out and fight, you cowards. And that's how these two ladies actually got captured. They were the only ones fighting.
What about the other one, Anne Bonny?
So like all pirates, including Blackbeard and all of them, there's very little known about where they grew up, etc. But apparently she came over from Ireland to make a new life with her father. And her father was hoping that she'd marry somebody special, but she married a sailor who was just useless. Then when Calica Jack arrived, she fell in love with him, and nobody knows what happened to her because she was not executed because she was pregnant. And so she disappeared. There's rumors she went back to her father. But when Calica Jack was hung, Mary Read died of fever in prison, and Anne Bonny disappeared from the records.
Well, I mean, pirates definitely made everything much more colorful. And as we said, all of these movies about pirates and all of these books that have been written since then have almost made them more famous than they would have been in their own time. And for most people, encountering pirates was a very rare thing, even in the times where there were huge fleets of them. But now, looking back, it must have been a very romantic, very exciting time, which is why it makes for such good fiction. And so much of it turns out to actually be true.
On the romantic side, it's always hard to say. It looked, I think it was a scary life, you know, living on the high seas in those days.
All right, that is piracy, arg. And we will return with more Blind History. We've had an incredible season, some absolutely amazing people, people that I had no idea existed, people that I'm hoping that you've discovered things about that you didn't know before. And as always, we're looking for your suggestions on who we can cover in these episodes. We've had some terrific ideas that have been provided by people who listen to the show, and we love that. That really is the way to go. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I managed to find a story from my own family history which relates to pirates. Somewhere back in the 1600s, one of my ancestors was actually hanged in England for piracy. I don't know how famous or how successful this pirate was, but he definitely met his end by being a pirate. And that, sure, was not unusual in those days, I suppose.
CliffCentral.com